This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
From Space City, USA, Paul Bosch presents Wrestling Spectacular, matching the world's top wrestlers in fierce competition.
Welcome to This Week in Wrestling, NWA On Demand. I'm Pete Schirmacher, and of course I'm with Johnny Sorrow. Johnny, man, you doing okay today?
No, I'm furious at work right now, and angry, but I'm focusing because I think I'm going to cheer myself up by talking about an amazing selection of material, and that's not me overselling it at all.
Did it not run the gauntlet this week?
It runs the gauntlet of great angles, great matches, interesting matches, some not so good. I mean, it covers everything, but there's something interesting about everything, and there's also one thing that in particular, it might be the greatest thing I've ever seen connected to professional wrestling in my entire fandom that everyone knows now is 86 years. Being able to talk about that, and then I'm going to watch the new Supergirl after that. I'm just going to lose myself in old school fucking wrestling and flying hot chicks fighting crime and bad guys. That's how I'm going to just...
And I watched it yesterday. No spoilers for you, but Kevin Smith directed.
I know. This is the one that Kevin did. Yeah.
Yep. So, hey. But, hey, let's kick it off with Ken Patera versus Steve Pardee from November 16th, 1979. And this is pretty interesting. This is definitely just a showcase for Patera because they're building to a Brody feud, I believe they were mentioned on there, right?
Yeah.
And this is all Patera. It was like a five-minute match. You see him working the arm and moving up the arm to the neck, and he eventually puts him out with the swinging neck breaker, which I think is just a really cool finisher. And Patera gets to show off his charisma and his he's such a really effective heel, especially in 79, 80, and 81. I think, like, I want to say 78 to 82 is really his, like, peak as a worker. And here he just dominates Steve Pardee, who, as a side note, really didn't have much of a career. I mean, he was, you know, he had these type of roles, but I know in 1985 they tried to do something with him in Portland, and he got a pretty good push there. And of course, he was lucky enough to work with the incredible Buddy Rose, and Buddy Rose can, like, almost make anybody look good.
Is that where I know his name from?
Yep.
Okay.
I'm sure there's a few matches of his and Buddy Rose on the 85.
I've never seen it. I think maybe from the magazines at the time. That's why I know that name.
And he worked in the AWA a little bit too, as an underneath babyface. And I think Buddy worked with him too over in the AWA also. But what were your thoughts here? You know.
Yeah, it was the swinging neckbreaker, the swinging Nelson as a. Bruce did this one. So we have no crowd noise in this, which is always kind of it's off for me.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. But, you know, you had to deal with, you have to deal with.
I'm not bitching.
Oh, yeah, I know you're not.
Hey, don't take that tone with me.
I know the difference between bitching Johnny and sarcastic Johnny.
No, I'm just, but, so there's a few observations. Patera's hair. He looks like Jimmy Feldman from the Bad News Bears. Remember that kid, Jimmy?
I'm trying to think of him, which one it was.
They had all the ones with the straight blonde hair, but he had the Harpo Marx blonde hair.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know why.
Exactly. I took that note. He is Gummo Marx's grandkid.
Yep. Did you have to look that up, or am I just really proud of myself that I knew that as this useless trivia in my lifetime?
I saw that today because when I looked it up, I saw the name of the actor and it said Brett Marx. And I was like, I wonder. And then I looked, like, at first I thought it must be Harpo's grandkid.
Yeah. You know,
it looks like Harpo. And then I see him, like, oh, Gummo. And I'm a Marx Brothers nerd, so I knew that Gummo was the brother who was in the vaudeville act before they went to the movies and didn't go to the movies. So I'm like, oh, okay, that's why he does. That's why he looks like one of the Marx Brothers. He's a Marx grandchild. So I saw that today. The fact that you knew that is bravo, sir.
Yeah, thank you. I know a little useless. I know some, Johnny Sorrow isn't the only one who knows useless 70s trivia. So there you go.
No, man. That's fantastic. I'm not even sarcastic. I tip my hat to that. I love people who know a lot of useless shit. But, and speaking of the 70s, JJ's outfit, which is purple and orange, and at first it just looks like that's what he looks like. He should be working at a Burger King in the 70s. He just needs a paper hat. But then you see later it's like a jogging suit. So that makes it extra 70s douchey. So then I loved it.
Total Ralph Furley type of outfit.
I mean, really, you can totally... you can totally see... He's... could you imagine? He would fit in amazingly at the Regal Beagle.
He easily could have taken over. Instead of Don Knotts replacing the Ropers, they could have easily... starring J.J. Dillon as the landlord.
Could you picture? They keep having to try to fool J.J. into thinking that Jack is gay. But with JJ's reactions.
Oh, God, yeah. But they find out, he finds out it's not because he's recording it from the closet.
They find him in the closet. dude, okay. I'm already in a better mood because I was just trying to get to a JJ in the closet joke, and you got there first. So, bravo. Once again, fantastic, fantastic. And that's all there really is to say about it. I mean, that's all there is to the match.
Yeah. But
again, that swinging full Nelson, I always thought was one of the cool... I don't care if the physics of it are bullshit, because it is one of the most visually awesome-looking moves there ever has been.
And you believe that it hurts like a mofo.
When I was a little kid, I sure did.
Hell yeah. And then this leads us to a public service announcement from Paul Bosch. It sounds like this is a series of them. Ooh. I hope we get more of them. I mean, I've never seen this on a wrestling show. I was just taking it back. I was like laughing my ass off because of how serious Paul was in talking about this. And I mean, I just wonder what women's groups would think about someone doing this now.
I think they'd appreciate his vigor.
Yeah.
And intentions.
But what about his bullshit statistics that he pretty much made up?
I wasn't thinking about the statistics because I was in utter disbelief at what I was watching and feeling a wave of joy.
Take it over. This is always your segments. These are better than anyone on the planet.
But I'm sure you felt a little of this too. I'm sure you were just like, not only is this the weirdest thing you ever heard, but you were laughing. So therefore you're like, this is amazing. I mean, it wasn't like you were going, this is awful.
No, I was laughing, and I'm also going, where's this going? And are we getting an angle out of this? Or
your mind was still in wrestling.
Yeah.
Okay. This is Paul Bosch, prominent man of Houston. Okay, from everything you've told me. And he has this show, he's had this show forever, he's a prominent man. And he is going to use it as his bully pulpit, you know. And that's for real. And because apparently he mentions that this is one of, in a series of Paul Bosch talking about the art of womanly defense. Okay. So he's going to, you get it right away, he's going to tell women how to defend themselves. And he goes, many have written in. I'm going to barely be able to get through this. And asked me for other tips and said, Mr. Bosch, is a dog a good tool in the art of womanly defense? And yes! And a good source of love. And he then basically tells you, you don't have to bother training it to defend you. So apparently a dog trainer stiffed him on a check at some time or another because he, you don't need to bother with that to have an attack dog. You just got to love him. And you know, the mere presence of the dog is enough to scare someone away, which is a very good point. You know, we've got dogs that bark like crazy. No one will come near here, but if anyone walked in the house, they'd lick them, you know. So, and then they say, what about going after a man's eyes? Because I always say going after a man's eyes. You can't go wrong with that. But I'll tell you what I'm an advocate of. And this, you already think you're in the Twilight Zone. And this is when it takes off. And the urgency gets in. The desperation in Paul Bosch's voice. And he means every goddamn word of this. Because he's in a panic. He is panicking like white America panicked on Election Day. He's an advocate of screaming and running. Running and screaming. I say be a running screamer.
I know.
And I'm like, okay. I was ready to run out the fucking front door screaming just because Paul Bosch told me so in this tone of voice. And he's in a panic. He's like, Soylent Green is people. or I got another one. To serve man is a cookbook. And some people will say, well, what if he's one of the good ones? There are no good ones. There are no good ones. And I'm like, holy fucking hell. He is in full mode. And he was referring to the people that say, if you scream, I'll hurt you. And he's like, don't fall for that. Don't be stupid. There's no such thing as a nice guy who's trying to hurt you. He goes, I have 8 other reasons. And those 8 reasons are 8 nurses in Chicago. And I knew immediately what he was referring to. Because I'm one of those. I love serial killer fucking books and shit. So I'm like, ooh, he's going to talk about Richard Speck. As soon as I thought that in my head, he goes, Richard Speck killed those 8 girls. Some he raped. And I was like, oh, is this on the Saturday morning wrestling show, right?
It's either that or the Friday night. They did a Friday night show and a Saturday morning show.
Okay. Anywho, he's like, well, let me tell you something about Richard Speck, and he has to bring this around to Texas goddamn Pride. Because Richard
Speck... But let me put it up. Let me also rephrase this, John. They weren't 2 separate shows. They were the identical show, so it did air on Saturday morning.
Okay. That's amazing. He goes, Richard Speck was in a Texas jail. You know, and someone the judge said he could get out. And there was a girl, and she was approached from behind. And she didn't fall for that. And she screamed, and he ran away, and they caught him. And that was Richard Speck. And they put him back in jail here in Texas.
Yep. In Huntsville, Houston.
In Huntsville. And he's sweating. And all I could say, this was the funniest thing I've seen, period. You know, but definitely in professional wrestling, it's not supposed to be funny. It's amazing. It's unlike anything, but... And I'm not making fun of Paul Bosch, because to the point, he is a major public figure, and he was using his bully pulpit to try to do good. And he was making up all kinds of wacky statistics and shit. And who gives a shit?
Well, the statistic was, one of them was the one who screamed lived. The other 8 died.
The other ones died.
Who didn't scream?
See? I like picture Paul Bosch at a hooker. You know, so, honey, for $500, you can have anything you like. What are you into? Running and screaming! It's insane. And I'm so happy it exists. So, Bruce, I'm begging you, as these come up, release them. Because it's the best, my favorite thing I've seen since the service started. And definitely the favorite thing I've seen since we've been doing this show. And I mean that in all sincerity. So, there you go.
I know. I thought it was great. I mean, it was such a change of pace too, and it was fun.
Think?
I mean,
from what, the Allen?
Yeah. Exactly. You know, we went from old school wrestling to actually sports entertainment. This
real. This is kayfabe.
I know it was kayfabe, but it felt like a Jim Cornette rant on Raw back in the day.
Well, no, unless he brought it around to, if he'd finally gotten to the end and said that. And Richard Speck, his cellmate, was Gary Hart. You know, they're like, oh, yeah. That's amazing. But no.
Oh, man. All right, man. Well, speaking of women, let's look at the women's match.
Ooh.
I know. Estella Molina versus La Pantera Serena. I don't know if I'm pronouncing their names right. September 22nd, 1980, and I gotta say, man, I was really impressed, and Paul was really putting over the women here, as explaining about how they're some of the best from Mexico, and how they do things differently, and I liked this, and I was, I thought it was pretty, really impressive for female wrestling in the 80s, and, I thought Estella was getting some serious heat from the crowd. She knew exactly how to piss them off, and she was a tremendous heel. Pantera's did these really cool comebacks with arm drags that were really neat looking. The fake hug spot was tremendous, and then the payback slap was a hell yeah. And that was all this action in the first fall. Really, it was you know, really fast paced, but not enough where it was so overwhelming. But they also played to the crowd, and they got their dynamics over of who was the heel and who was the baby face. And the second fall, you see Estella, who's clearly the heel, is just beating the crap out of Pantera. We see Pantera. We do a really, she does this really neat Arana from a headstand position. And now you see Estella, she's biting the forehead. The 1-2 combo by Pantera was nasty, super fun fall. And then the third fall, again, Estella working the crowd, you know, getting heat. Big back senton by Pantera. And we see Pantera with some really nice looking punches. And we get a real fun finish to this bout. I thought it was like a 3.25-star match. I really was impressed by these girls. And they worked a different pace than the normal women that we've seen on the service. And I thought Estella was a great A heel. And I'm like Matt D was mentioning that he thinks this is like a super, super fine because he used the proper term for what luchador, female luchadors are. There's not a whole lot of footage of these girls, and this is a real find for the service and stuff, especially if you're into this. What do you think of all this?
Maybe JJ has footage where he was hiding in their closet.
Yeah.
I love that they still call it a girls' match. A girls' match? And I was like, yeah, it's a good thing they don't speak English. Like, you know, not the girls. And because it was like watching my mom and one of her friends get into a fight at the pool. these two broads. Because they raided my mom's bathing suit closet, apparently. Because that's all I could think of. Looking at them, I'm like, those are my mom's bathing suits from the 70s. Which is what they were, actually. That's what they wrestled in at the time. These weren't specially made tights. It's exactly what those were. And it was distracting to the point of ridiculousness for me. And yes, Estella was amazing heel, though. That was, you know, the crowd was eating that shit up with a fucking spoon. But then we also get a great Paul Bosch line after a hair pulling segment. He says, you know, I've always said that they should legalize hair pulling in girls' matches because it's just natural for girls to pull hair. Women are genetically programmed. They can't help it. When they fight, they pull hair. That's what they do. You know, birds gonna fly, fish gonna swim, chicks are gonna pull hair when they fight. He's got a point. But anyway, the old men at ringside, I think this is a hoot, and it's one side of the ringside crew is a bunch of old men One guy is just smoking a cigarette and looks like he has no teeth. And he's about 80 and he's having a blast. He's laughing his ass off.
Yep.
And then with a few, and he's sitting with a couple of Mexican older men too. And they're just like, hey. And then the other side is a bunch of like super slick, cool, late teen, early 20s dudes. Like one guy's got a big fro and the other guy looks like fucking Freddie Prince, sitting back with the big feathered hair and they're all like this cool bunch of dudes. And I was like, those are the fathers and those are the sons. And they're like, we're going to sit over here. You guys sit over here. But yeah, I mean, as far as the wrestling goes, you know, there's still the little lucha things that bother some people.
Right.
You know, you just got to get used to, but you know, they went out and worked their asses off. Because you know, we want to talk, whenever we say stuff like, yeah, you know, that Moolah and all them were some tough old broads. I'd imagine these chicks, just as or if not more.
Yeah. So Stella looks like she could go into the dressing room and slap the shit out of Gina.
Not the shit. Dude, she walk into the men's locker room and smack the shit out of someone who had something to fucking say.
Yep.
Boom, not give a fuck. No, not one you, fuck.
Totally with you, but yeah, this is definitely a find for the service. So if you guys haven't checked it out, man, definitely check it out. It's worth a while. Even some people I know have a adverse thing to females wrestling, but more they're getting more used to it now with it being more mainstream. But this is really state of the art what they were doing in 1980.
Well, it's good also because I think we are now going to get, because we're all a bunch of old motherfuckers. There's a generation of wrestling fans who are right now. It's their favorite thing.
Yeah.
And despite what criticism we might have about stuff, they're looking at women wrestling and it's not a novelty to them. And these are athletic people and there's no like looking down on them. Not currently. And that's not what they're seeing on TV. So they're going to get interested in it. And so it's cool that we have stuff like this. So the ones that go completely insane in their fandom, like you and I, then go track this shit down.
Yeah, and then on the WWE, the next tournament they're doing is the women's tournament. So
yeah, you know, so it is what it is.
It's getting embraced.
So then some kid goes, "Oh, there's old luchador Adora. I wonder what that is like. You know, where can I find that?"
Yep.
Now, I'm positing a theory here, but you know, so far the only place I know, and we've seen a few of them, is this.
Yeah. So man, why don't we take a break right now? And we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation, Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds as well. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out on the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your...
And we are back, and man, our next thing we're looking at is just some clips from the great Scott from Mr. N versus Mr. Moto. You know, I'm not a big guy who loves like clips of stuff. I like it when it comes to angles. Just seeing a 5-minute match really doesn't do a whole lot for me. But for some, it's cool for a historic perspective to look at these guys. And if you want to see really some more Mr. Moto in his prime, you really should check out the Chicago Film Archives on YouTube. Mm. I think they have about 100 matches or so up of stuff from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and I believe they have a few Mr. Moto matches, and
they do.
Yeah, and I thought he was really effective in what he did, and he was really good at what he did. I mean, he definitely played a stereotypical role.
Oh, you think?
Yeah.
The name is
Mr. Moto. Yeah.
What's funny is Mr. Moto was a character who was a good guy. He was like a second rate Charlie Chan.
Yeah.
It was Mr. Moto, who was a good guy at one point. And when the war started, it just became an American slang term. Hey, Moto. You know, it was like it was less offensive than Jap, but it was still a racial slur. So his name is actually a racial slur.
Yeah, but whenever I do think of Mr. Moto, that's exactly what I think of. It's Charlie Chan, honestly, when I would describe him and stuff. Do you have any thoughts about the clips or anything?
Yeah, I do. I would imagine that this would be a feature he did every now and then. And now here on Bosch Wrestling. Which, in that case, if I was watching this at the time, I think I'd love it.
Yes.
Yeah, as a 6-minute segment once a week, you know, or every other week.
Oh yeah, I think in the presentation of a TV show, I think it's fantastic, honestly.
Oh yeah, it really is, because he's doing it. This is all done in studio with in studio narration. He sounds great, and the great Scott, which I'd love to know. Like, so he's supposed to be from Scotland? No. So he's just the great Scott, and he's got really long blonde hair. And Paul Bosch explains that at the time, because he gives you a little history lesson here. A history lesson on, number one, blondes in wrestling, which he then pointed out Buddy Rogers was the first guy, or Gorgeous George was, but that he said at the time Buddy Rogers was so successful as a bleach blonde villain that everybody was doing the bleach blonde gimmick. And then he said some were successful with it and some were just seen as imitators. and then he mentions... this is more interesting. He talks about Mr. Moto. And I don't know if this is bullshit or not, but apparently, at this current time this aired, Mr. Moto is still involved in the wrestling business. He's retired. But he's basically, I guess, supposed to be the star maker for Americans wanting to go to Japan. He's like, when any American wrestler who wants to go to Japan, the Japanese wrestling cartels or something, he says, the investments or something, they go to Mr. Moto for his word. And if Mr. Moto says yes, they can go. And if he says no, you can't go to Japan and get that big Japanese money. And I was like, I don't know if that's true, but I want it to be true, so it's true. and Duke... I'm sorry, I can never pronounce his last name.
Duke Kiyomura or something like that. Kamoa. I can't say it either, but yeah.
But we've seen him before.
Yes.
And he's talking about him, and then he gets into the fact that in post-World War II America, and he's explaining there was a time that, and he says anything Oriental, the fans would boo it. Because... he even says, to this very day, the fans like to say, go back to Japan. And he gives a very interesting, quick history lesson. He's not defending it, or is he shitting on it? He's basically saying, this is kind of like it was at the time, and, well, maybe kind of, like, he's acknowledging that this is hard to look at from a racial perspective, and he's giving you the history lesson behind it to explain why. Look, this is what this was, and this was a period of time, and this is why these reactions were happening. And I found that fascinating, because no professional wrestling show I ever watched growing up took the time to give you a little history lesson. That's amazing. I would have loved that when I was a kid.
I know. Loved it. Told you. Totally with you, man. Which leads us to our next segment, which is... where am I at here? Oh, yeah, which is Tony Atlas versus Jerry Brown... February 22nd, 1980, And my God, we start off with the Tony Atlas promo, and he has his shirt that says "Ladies, walk on my chest." Which, if you know all the Atlas stories about him and his shoes, and
have I ever told that story?
Well, you did a bio on it on Titans once.
Oh,
but it's a known. I mean, it's not like it's a Johnny Storo secret story. You're the only one who knows.
I know,
it's pretty common knowledge ever since he especially appeared on MTV.
I just don't remember if I ever told that story.
Yeah.
Are you sure?
On Titans.
Okay, well, no, dude, I know. I've told that story probably a million times I've told that story to strangers.
Oh my God.
I gotta hear about this guy, Tony Atlas.
And yeah, and it was just great that he actually has that shirt and...
It's bonkers, because it doesn't say "ladies walk on my chest." It says "ladies walk on chest." He drops the "my."
I guess does it?
Yeah,
okay.
Because this was when you still had to go down to the mall or the boardwalk. Or you know, not the mall, like the cheap mall, and have them make a T-shirt for you. So he had to go and ask for this, and he's like, they charge by the letter. What can I drop off? See, and I need the ladies. Definitely need the ladies, and I need the walk. I gotta have the walk. That's very important. On's good. I need on and chest. Definitely chest. Ladies walk on chest. It even seems more like he's really ordering them that way. And I laughed so hard because, of course, we all know the stories. Of course, I went off like crazy. I've never seen him wear a T-shirt proclaiming his goddamn his kink.
Yes, I mean, yeah.
I'm looking down on him, man. Look, I mean, his thing is, you know, that's control, his fetish, let's say. You know, not hurting anybody. He's the only one getting hurt, and that's good with him, so who gives a shit? But to proclaim that on your shirt on television, that is advertising, my friend.
Yep.
Because because most people probably saw that and said, I don't even know what that means.
Yep.
And there was chicks in the audience who go, ooh, I know what that means. And they were getting a backstage pass down to the wrestling matches.
That's how he separated his rats.
He advertised for his rats just like that, man. And that's as much of a joke as that is that we just made, that's probably true.
Yeah.
Amazing. This footage just keeps giving. And then, did you want to go into the match itself?
Well, yeah. First we get that Geno challenge.
Right,
And which is I want to see an Atlas Geno match, and I know we got a tag match with them, and I've watched anyway, and I think Geno's been gold with everybody, this leads to a big confrontation in the ring, a fight ensues, and Geno of course powders out, and Jerry Brown attacks, and Jerry Brown is just he might be the long lost cousin of. Killer Tim Brooks, because he's a dirty motherfucking looking guy.
You know who he looks like? He looks like the ugly guy in Three Dog Night. You know, every band like that had like the one really ugly motherfucker, and that's who Jerry Brown was. This is not the governor of California, my friends. This guy did not fuck Linda Ronstadt. This guy just got done. You know, it might have been. Because they used to run shows at the same time as the State Fair. So Three Dog Night might have played earlier. And he came down and wrestled because he needed the money. Good boy.
But Jerry Brown has been a history of being a good worker. I mean, he was in a tag team of the Hollywood Blondes with him and Buddy Roberts.
Is that Jerry Brown?
I'm pretty sure.
I didn't even make that connection.
Yeah.
But he seemed like he knew what he was doing in the ring. Don't get me wrong. But boy, what a look.
Yeah, I think that was the gimmick, because he was supposed to, Buddy Roberts was the real blonde guy, while this guy was the ugly one, you know? Kind of like the Midnight Express.
Both Dennis and Bobby were ugly as fuck. That's what made it so funny.
Right.
But, I mean, because this guy, he wasn't blonde here, man. He just had the long hair. I mean, he looked like he just took off his cap, because the hair's flared out on
his
sides. But I could believe it, because you could tell that this guy was probably a really good worker at one time or another.
Yeah, and he's definitely, he's also a guy you might remember a lot. This is where my main memory comes from is he was the main jobber in the Fire and Ice video for Ric Flair when the Fire and Ice video, one of the famous first videos I've ever seen in wrestling.
I don't know what that is.
And he was based out of St. Louis. Yeah, you got to see it. He worked the Kansas City territory. I really enjoyed what they were doing here. I mean, I thought, Brown attacks, Atlas makes the comeback, and Atlas showing, flashes of athleticism like the arm drags. And, for a guy his size, he does a flying head scissors. I've always liked Atlas jumping headbutt. I always think that looks really neat. I like Jerry Brown going old World of Sport using some joint manipulation, like pretending he's breaking the fingers and stuff.
Yeah, I like joint manipulation.
Yeah, I'm digging the trunk pulls, and I thought his heel work was really solid. I thought that the rope running spot was a little sloppy, but overall I thought it was solid stuff. The main takeaway is that we're going to get an Atlas Geno feud, and I thought this was a decent filler match to get us to the next destination for Tony Atlas. It was a good way to get him over. What were your thoughts here?
Oh, I cannot wait to see Geno and Tony Atlas in a match, because I think we've all seen this. We've seen it on Titans and all the other stuff. We definitely see it here, Tony Atlas was good.
He has good physical tools, who just needed somebody to lead him through a match, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. Tony Atlas was really good. But not everyone is the ring general. It takes two to be a dance partner, and if you're a really good dance partner to a guy who is a really good lead, you're a really good dancer. You know everything to do when you do it, and we see it especially here. I mean, goddamn it, because Jerry Brown did not look easy to get up over his fucking head. Not that any guy is, but boy, that looked like a sack of fucking potatoes, man. And he just got him up like that. I was like, goddamn, man. And but the Geno stuff at the beginning, he's in the ring, he's bad mouthing Tony, and he does this big giant exaggerated like shine my shoes pantomime, that's just insane. And it's one of those things. It's stuff like that. A lot of people, like, again, to Paul Bosch's point, this is what things were like then. I'm not defending it, but I'm not going to get upset about it. It was a long time ago. Don't worry about it. Okay. And because he gets on the microphone, and Tony Atlas.
And you also got to remember, it was the heel doing it.
Heels
are bad people. They didn't get a bad reputation for being good, nice, and being politically correct. They did it by being racist assholes Ted DiBiase kicking the basketball away from the little black kid. I mean
I don't even think that was racist, but I mean, I just thought the kid just happened to be black.
I agree, but I'm just saying, though. I mean, heels don't do nice things. I was just using it as an example of a heel not doing something nice.
I get what you're saying, though, and it's so funny because when they have used race stuff in recent years, I mean, I don't even think they'll touch on it anymore. Everyone goes, "Oh, it's cheapy. That's cheapy. That's cheapy." And I'm going, when you watch all this old stuff, and you go, it's exactly the cheap point. No, these are villains. And racism is an awful, terrible thing. And these are people who are looking at it. They're not looking at it as us watching it and being entertained and going, boy, I want to. Like, when I see guys do racist shit, and I was a heel fan, if racism came into it, I'm like, nope, not with them. I'm going to cheer for the Rock and Roll Express. Fuck you. Nope. I mean, I wouldn't cross that even as a heel fan. And so it's been around forever, and they're villains, but, so you have to accept it that way instead of, I'm going to dissect this program and tell you what's wrong with it. I was like, no, this is part of that performance, because there wasn't, I'm not going to say anybody, there's probably some people muttering under their breath, yeah, you tell them, but you can also get racist hillbillies in that crowd who want Tony Atlas to kick that motherfucker's ass, who probably use a lot worse language on the drive home.
Yeah.
Okay? So he gets on the mic,
And one other thing, finally, I'm sorry to interrupt, though, but, it's part of our history. I mean, that's I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but that's this is a snapshot of American history at the time too.
And that's why, and I'll admit this. I'll always admit this. Jerry Lawler is one of my favorite wrestlers of all time, but Jerry Lawler used a lot of racist shit as a baby face.
Yeah,
that always bothered me. When he's like, "Let me tell you something, Kamala. I'll just wet your lips and stick you to the wall." And I heard that, I was like, I can't. And that doesn't mean I'm going to hate Jerry Lawler. I still love Jerry Lawler as a performer and a wrestler. That shit fucking don't. I'm not going to make excuses for it.
Right.
I won't. I refuse. That's fucking bullshit. You know, but if he was a villain and Kamala was the good guy.
Yeah.
Then I can't wait to see Kamala kick this racist ass.
Yeah.
It can only be that way. And then, But, so, and then speaking of what you say on the mic, Gino, he's not saying, "Tony Atlas, you're not a real man. You're just a boy. Oh, boy. Oh, boy." And, you know, that's a fucking racial slur.
Yep.
You know, right there. And that's when Tony Atlas has had enough. And he gets on that microphone. "Let me tell you something, Gino Hernandez. My mama didn't raise no boy. She raised a 280-pound, 6'8" brick house." And I was like, "Motherfucker, he's going to eat you alive." I wanted him to – I love Gino as a bad guy. I wanted Tony Atlas to kick the shit out of him. And then Gino attacks. Tony kicks it, turns it around, and kicks his ass. And fucking press slams that motherfucker. Boom! You know, and Gino goes running away. And I was just so happy. And then the match happened, and the match, it was what it was. But it was nowhere near as exciting. And that's what, exactly. Just got Tony over, exactly what you said. And now that whole crowd is like, "Okay, that's Tony Atlas, that was cool. We can't wait to see him get Gino in the ring." So it was perfect that way.
Exactly. And now we go to, like, Southwest Championship Wrestling. It's an angle. Paul Bosch is actually, I guess, visiting there. They do that a lot.
Is that what that was? I was wondering. I was going to ask
you. Yep.
Because I knew this was Southwest. I was like, well, why is Bosch there?
Bosch, whenever he's coming down every now and then. Like, you remember the... we can talk about it on Mid-South. You remember the Mid-South Gorilla angle? Bosch was on commentary for it.
Oh, that's right.
And why? It was because he was in cahoots with Watts and stuff, and so they Bosch would come in every now and then, and that's why Jim Ross would show up in Houston here and there.
Well, I knew the connection with Bill Watts, but I didn't know that he could also just go down to Southwest and say, "Hey, I'm visiting."
Well, because at the time he was using Southwest talent. He had a deal with Joe Blanchard, and that's where we have like the footage right now in '82. Is Southwest Championship Wrestling. That's where we have Gino and Tully and Ricky Morton and Bob Sweden and the Grappler, and those guys are from Southwest Championship Wrestling.
You know, it just needs to be said again, especially after the history that you've given and everything we've learned. Paul Bosch was a goddamn genius at promoting this form of entertainment.
Yeah, and so at the time, and so genius. So every now and then he'd go down to San Antonio and do something like this, which was him, calling a match, which turned into this angle, which was pretty awesome. Why don't you explain it, man? I loved it.
Well, I'm just thinking about what you just said. It's really blowing my mind because he can scout talent that way.
Yeah.
Do everything, and he's so well respected. He can go anywhere he wants.
He'd make the booking deals, and I mean. For a while there, it was like the world class, like in the early mid-70s, and it was that. And then in 82, I think it was like late 81, 82, he used Southwest Championship Wrestling. Then from like 83 to 86, he used Watts, and then quit, went to WWE, did that for a while, for about 6 months, and they just hated each other. And then he did maybe another 6 months with... where he was really out of it completely, and was after Peter Burkholz. They'd have Paul Bosch in the studio do shoot arounds where he'd come in for a day and do all these shoot arounds for a month, and that's when WCW was on the air, where they finally finished out.
But you got to think, even him and Vince didn't get along. You got to think that still was just an ultimate sign of A, respect on Vince's part for Paul Bosch, and B, that's to my point about Paul Bosch, right up at the very goddamn end, because we all see he was already quite a feeble old man at this time, you know. And what's the last thing he does? What's the hottest thing? Is WWF at that time. And he gets in bed with that, man, right up to the end, man. He knows, he goes around, he's finding the best stuff. Because that Watts period at the time, we all know that's some of the best wrestling there was.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a hot item. World class at the time was a super hot item. I think Gary Hart might have criticized him for jumping around to what was hot, you know, but to the point of being a businessman who promotes professional wrestling in his city. That's smart. That's amazingly smart. But
and then when he had the falling out with Harley Race, because he was the NWA champion, he did a no show, as a promoter, especially the NWA champion no showing her show, he ends up cutting a deal with Nick Bockwinkel where he buys into the territory, and that's where you see him, where you get the AWA affiliation, because Bockwinkel bought into the territory for Percentile.
Yeah, and at that time, that was at a period of time where the three world championships were, even though it was a fake sport, you know, they all held a credibility for the audience.
Yep.
They all did. And so I just keep, more and more, I just keep being amazed. By some of that, at the first, we all made silly jokes about it. More and more, I just keep being amazed that this man was a genius business.
He's one of the few guys who had all three world champions on one show.
It's amazing. It's amazing. But to this, we love you, Paul.
Yeah.
To the angle. So a very young Tom Pritchard, we pick it up, I guess, in the middle of the match. Who knows? I'm sure Tom Pritchard didn't get in a lot of offense.
Yeah, he was at the time for Southwest Championship Wrestling. Him and Magnum TA were the two young Lions type guys.
Okay.
Who were like, kind of like in Titans lore would be like the Kurt Hennig type of role.
Oh, right. There. We've talked about it. You and I did the Magnum show, so yep. We all about that. Tom Pritchard's one of those guys. That's awesome. But yeah, Dick Slater just beating the fucking dog shit out of him. And he posts him, and Tom's bleeding all over the fucking place. At one point, you see him, his head goes down onto the mat outside, and he comes up, and there's this huge smear of blood on the ring apron. It's like, oh, and I love the vampire in me comes out. You're like, oh, I love this shit in wrestling. Yep. And then this move, Slater suplexes Tom in and goes for the 1-2-3. And the ref won't count it because of that one obscure rule that they used to do where you couldn't pin a guy as a result of a move bringing him in.
Yeah.
You know? And so at first Paul's like, no, that is the rule. So then, Paul was just like, oh, really? What the fuck's wrong with you? Because he went for a pinball, you know? Like, it was like, what's this ref doing? And then Slater just like drops like three vicious looking knee drops. Vicious. This is the shit. You could do a spinning atomic mega fuck super kick 380 whatever, but to drop a fucking knee on a guy's face like this, and we all know, completely not touch him.
Precision.
Not touch him. And that sort of precision is the most impressive thing about professional wrestling. And boy, does Dick Slater do it here. It looks insane.
It was brutal.
I mean, he might be a Terry Funk guy. He's like, well, you thought they looked so good because I really do hit you, you know? But that's it. That was his mentor.
Well, that's the other thing. Like a lot of the old-timers on TV, they are a firm believer in laying in a little stiffer because the TV cameras are there and they need to sell people getting into there. So I wouldn't be surprised if he laid one of those things were a pretty stiff knee drop, too.
Yeah, but I mean, these look like they should have shattered his jaw.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it was like, it was crazy. It looked like he hit him in the face with a fucking sledgehammer. But so then finally, then Paul says, he's like, well, maybe he should have just done the three count because look at what's happening now. And he gets the three count. He's beating him up some more. Manny Fernandez comes running in and saves the day, taking care of Tom. And Manny shows that he's dumb and actually turns his back on Dick Slater. And it was just so, you saw, well, saw that coming. And so Slater blindsides him. And I was like, and I was just thinking, Manny, I love you, but fucking, hey, what are you, fucking high? You know?
Wait till he gets out of the ring, yeah.
Wait till he gets out of the ring, dumb. And And then he gets posted. And this is all just so Manny is like, there's going to be any blood on the show, brother. I'm going to get some blood on the show, brother. I'll show you how to bleed. You know, even in a run-in, Manny Fernandez bleeds on a run-in. He then turns it around and saves the day and does toss Slater around. Slater gets to walk away because they're leading to a match between these two guys. What's that?
Tonight, that's what he said. And they'll be at the Hemisphere tonight. Yep.
So he bladed in the run-in and has to go out. Oh, that's fantastic. I want to see this. I hope it exists because I've seen these guys fight, gosh, probably tons of times. You know, I know I've seen them fight in Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah.
You know, but I want to see them in this audience with this much with blood and shit at this point in their careers. That's all what it was. They said at the Coliseum Friday night.
I thought they said the Hemisphere Arena, because I thought for sure, maybe it was. I thought this was for the San Antonio market.
Oh, no, it says, I actually took that note, because I think I thought to myself, where's this going to be? Oh, no, because it was all brutal, and then, because Bosch says, and he goes, and you want to see these two get their hands on each other at the Coliseum Friday night. And I'm like, I'm buying, if I'm in that audience, I'm begging my mom, can we go to the Coliseum Friday night?
Yeah, it was a great closing angle, you know what I'm saying? Heat, and it was awesome. Now, I want to talk about Tom Pritchard for a bit, for a few minutes. Do you have any, like, great Tom Pritchard memories or anything like that?
No. And here's why. Somehow, Tom Pritchard's career and my wrestling fandom never really intertwined.
Okay.
I never got... There was never any promotion that he was on was something that was available to me, or
that
at least,
right.
at least, it's definitely not in the 80s when I was really into wrestling. And then when Smoky Mountain was around, I wasn't watching wrestling, and I probably had no way to watch it anyway, not in New Jersey. I remember seeing him in magazines, because even when I wasn't really watching a lot, I'd still like pick up a magazine every now and then and flip through it, and I'd see his name. So then he was on one of the Body Donnas, and I knew that this guy was, he's supposed to be some respected guy. And then the ECW run, where I do remember the whole thing where he comes out and the crowd's shitting on him, you know, and at the end of it, they were chanting, Zip is dead, because he fucking, so there you go, there's a memory, Zip is dead, and because Tom Pritchard fucking took that ECW crowd, who was shitting on him at first, and by the end of it, it's Zip is dead chance because he went and fucking killed it. And I don't even remember who he was wrestling. So there's that for something that I experienced. But as far as looking back goes, is definitely, and he doesn't really have much to do with it, but it's the I'd like to talk to Tom angle with Dirty White Girl, you know, which I think is the greatest thing of all, one of the greatest things of all time that a lot of people tend to. People loved that for the longest time when it was first available, like online, getting passed around. And now, like, people are like backpedaling on it a little bit. Like, they don't like it as much as they used to. I was like, I don't know why. I think it's still brilliant.
But, right, so do I. I'm with you on it. I love the angle.
But yeah, that's it. But I was never at his height. I just never got to see him.
Yeah,
so.
He was a weird bird. He's a guy for me. Same here. When I was watching live. I mean, I've seen him pop up in Houston here and there, but he was a guy who, it was just because I'm an avid, you know, footage collector, is where I've seen it as all in watching back. Like, you know, I loved him in Continental. I thought him and Dirty White Boy had one of the best brawls just I'd ever seen, but it just worked perfectly, where these guys are just punching, kicking, bleeding, choking, you know, how a brawl is supposed to be worked. He was just a good, believable worker. I liked his work as half of the Body Don, not Body Don's, but Heavenly Bodies. I liked his run in USWA Texas. I loved his feud with Jarrett, and then I liked him and Emory in Memphis, and he was just a guy I thought had always had really good psychology and told a good story in the ring.
Well, I mean, that's why he's a trainer that all the guys who train with him love.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I liked actually. Now that you mentioned it, because you said the Body Donnas and immediately went like ugh and gagged in your mouth just like I did. But I'd like to step back and go, okay, aside from this gimmick, this is Tom Pritchard and Chris Candido.
Yeah.
Managed by Tammy.
Yep.
I'd like to take a look back and see what matches that were out there on pay-per-view and who they were wrestling, because that sounds like a pretty fucking good tag team, dumb name aside.
And I just they were just working matches. Terrible teams. They were working like the Smoking Guns.
And, I mean, the Smoking Guns could get that. I would see that though, because the Smoking Guns could get carried to good matches at
the
that.
Godwins, you know. So
the Godwins as babyfaces were the worst. So, yeah.
So I think it'd be tough. But he's also, I don't know if how much you know about his history in Houston, but he was Paul Bosch was the one who gave him his break.
I read that somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, he used to work behind the scenes in Houston. You see him a lot of times in the footage watching the matches. So he was almost like a Japan young boy in a way, where all them in Japan they watch the matches right at ringside, and that's how kind of Dr. Tom got all these greats coming through Houston. He learned how to probably tell a story by just watching the matches, you know.
Do you think Paul Bosch made Dr. Tom wash his feet?
I doubt it. I hope not. All right. With that, on that note, we're gonna take a break and we'll be right back.
PWOPTBN Feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
And we are back, and we're looking at the main event, and we are looking at the Spoiler versus Bruiser Brody for the U.S. title, November 16th, 1979. I believe the service has the date wrong, because this crowd did not look like the same crowd in the Patera match. So one of these dates are wrong. I'm not sure which.
Really?
Yeah, I just can't put my... I don't know. But, I mean, I'm sure... it's just tough. I got to do some research on it. You know, Bruiser Brody is a guy, especially on Pro Wrestling Only, he's kind of been a guy who's been pretty, like, been shit on because of...
Shit on. You can say shit on because that's putting it lightly.
Yeah. And, you know, and part of it, I think, might be... I mean, yeah, okay, we see a lot of Japan footage, and mm-hmm. I think he tries to protect himself a little too much in Japan. And then we've seen him in other areas where he did not get along with the promoters as well. But, you know, mm-hmm. two promotions he did get along well with the promoters were St. Louis and Houston.
Oh, that good point.
And Houston, the footage, this match he looked fantastic in. There's one that we'll talk about next week. I'll say he looked incredible on. He's looked pretty good. So in a lot of a lot of these matches here in Houston, and I think it has something to do with the fact that he got along with the promoters and would be and worked a little. I don't want to say worked harder, but would be willing to show a little bit more. And you know, he got along in World Class with Fritz too, you know.
Yep.
And then, you know, he had good matches with Abby there. I mean, I think it has something to do with the fact that he trusted the promoter more, and therefore he would sell a little bit more and make the matches more compelling.
I think that is an amazing and dead on point, and it never occurred to me that way, because I had mine, because I mentioned, I might as well go with it now, because I had my Brody thing, which is about some of the same things, but that's fantastic. I didn't even think of that, because he's a guy who is not attached to any one territory. He's a traveling guy, and when you're a traveling guy at this time, you have to protect your image. You have to. And this was a cutthroat business, so you only go out there and put yourself in the position to possibly, you know, get a pinfall, whatever it is at this time, or whatever, to look bad, or whatever that means. But at the time, it did, to promoters that you trust that you're not going to get fucking double-crossed, because these are all a bunch of shady motherfuckers. And Paul, to your point, he trusted Fritz, he trusted Paul, he trusted
Sam Mushnick,
and that's why that's perfect. That's dead on. I was all... that kills mine. Because I was going to just point out that I think maybe as well, maybe this can play into it, this we're seeing a lot of younger Brody here.
That too.
Okay, because you got older Brody at a time. Because remember, when we first saw Bruiser Brody, he had fucking gray hair, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
And he's at this point, he's like, fuck no, this is how I make my living. And I have an aura to do. Because no one in those crowds, as far as I know, in those crowds in Japan were fucking complaining. You know,
no.
He was a huge over there. The style that everyone just like he's shitting on here was making him a lot of money over there. And no one in Japan was going, oh, Brody. They fucking loved him. They loved that act. He had to protect that act. He made a lot of money for his family with that act.
Protect that aura. Yep.
But this young Brody that we're seeing, that I was going that route. I'm like, maybe we just need to see more young Brody because we obviously really haven't. But you add that to young Brody in a promotion where he respects the promoter and doesn't think he's going to get double-crossed, so he's willing to put himself in more at more risk of losing or getting double-crossed, like laying on your back, you know, and getting shoot-pinned.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense, brother. That's fantastic. Mm.
And let's get to the match, man. Spoiler is a guy who I think looks really
good.
He's
so good.
Yeah, and I say it again and again. I mean, he's the Undertaker of the 70s and early 80s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He has that aura. He has that size. And then, you know, in the history books show it. I mean, he actually had a hand in training the Undertaker, which I think is super cool. Spoiler is really good at using, like, leverage moves and... He turns this into a brawl. You see both guys using chairs, and we get the first fall. Brody makes this nice comeback and drops the big Bruiser Brody knee for the pin. The second fall, again, it's another slugfest, and the spoiler, his finisher is the claw, and he's teasing it like Jake used to tease that DDT, and Brody's fighting it. Then we see another tease of the claw, and then another one, and finally he gets it. Brody is struggling. Spoiler to the top with a forearm, and then we get some more brawling back and forth, and then finally he gets him again with the claw. And I love how he uses the knee, the positioning of the knee, or the pretty much put it right over Brody's throat and shoulders to from the count the pinfall with the claw. So I like the psychology and the symmetry right now. Both guys' falls have gone with their finisher, where it takes their big. They got to use their big gun to knock each other out with, because nothing else has been working. And the third fall, I thought was just epic, and they were just brawling all over the place, overhand shots from the spoiler. I love the top spoiler going to the top, and he hits this gigantic elbow. They take it to the outside, and you really got into this final fall. I'm just totally buying into everything they're doing. Brody using the mic cord as a weapon was really nasty, and it was a nice little callback to how Spoiler was using his strap as like a choking Brody earlier. So again, you know, nice revenge spot in the third fall. And this is all action brawl. Spoiler trying to go back to the claw, but for Brody to have an answer. He learned from the last time. And which was, he gets the claw, but he brings, takes the spoilers going up for more leverage, but King Kong Brody picks him up with a super slam from the top, freaking running knee drop again, and I love, he goes with his finisher, his go-to move to knock out the spoiler. Great, great action, great psychology, actually, that's all interwoven in here, with some nice little revenge spots, some callback spots. I thought it was really well worked, and the more I watch it, I think I gave it 3.5 stars. I think I'm talking to myself to even giving up to 3 3/4, even 4. Yeah, I liked it. I know. I just thought it was a hell of a freaking fun brawl.
Oh yeah.
Both guys, and then we get this wacky Bruiser Brody promo afterwards. Oh man, it was just great stuff. Just a great, great final, great at main event, and one of them great, just cool Houston wrestling moments, man. What do you think of the match and the promo?
Gotta tell you, at first it threw me again because it was no crowd noise.
Yeah. But you think if they had crowd noise, I think this crowd would have been going freaking bananas.
Well, you could see it.
Yeah.
Especially at the end, you could definitely see it. And again, it is what it is. someone dub it in. You know, I don't care. They can CGI in Grand Moff Tarkin in a movie that's made $1 billion. Bruce, I give you permission as a fan. Just throw in some old crowd noise. I don't give a shit. Because I'm kidding, but this was so got so epic, like you said, that I kind of forgot it. And then when I saw the crowd reaction at the end, I was like, oh, I want to hear that.
Yeah.
Those people were going, as Pat Patterson would say, banana. And Bruce at one point, and it's so funny because he goes, this is one of the greatest matches ever. And it's great. I want to hear that call, not over silence. It just, it's, ooh, it's jarring. But to the point of the match, that finish was so awesome because exactly, it was like, you hit the finisher, this guy hit his finisher. But they did the great, it didn't come totally out of nowhere. So the crowd got a chance to gasp as they're seeing is this going to happen? Because title changes were rare when we were kids,
Very rare.
And Brody comes up, and you saw when he came down with that knee, and the people were waiting to the last second for the spoiler to roll. And boom, it didn't happen. And you see the reaction happen before the three count. Boom! And he's got that American belt. And I was like, fuck, damn, that was awesome. Awesome match. And then the promo. Because Bruiser Brody gives no shits about anything or any goddamn buddy. Except for poor young guys that, you know, out here trying to earn a living, getting crippled by Ken Pantera. I was like, I know that Brody, if he'd lived, would have been a Pantera fan, so I dug it. and he gives us all, because he's also mentioned he's going to face the world's strongest man. And first he gives us a promo about it. He's like, when I came in here 2 years ago, Paul, you know, that title's mine, so I was just taking back my property. And he's like, well, you might be putting your property, you're going to be putting your property on the line against Ken Patera, the world's strongest man. And he's like, and he gives him a look with his bug eyes like, I don't give a fuck about Ken Patera or his manager, James Dillon. Remember, I always have to get used to calling him James Dillon down there. And because the winner of this match also gets a shot at Harley Race, which is what is the end game, which is, again, I can't imagine what it'd be like growing up in a territory where the world champion only shows up once or twice a year and like looking forward to that as a fan. Like, when's the world champion showing up again? You know, that's gotta be, I can't imagine that kind of suspense and going, that's the ticket. Okay, Mom, I have a choice between that or this. You know, the champion's coming to town. Yeah. You know, that doesn't happen every, can't imagine what that's like. It must be amazing. And it's all about, you know, Harley Race. He's bad-mouthing Harley Race, but he's out of his mind, and it's awesome. He's an amazing promo.
Yep.
He's an amazing promo.
He's a wild man,
He's a wild man, but he's a little southern, and he's not dumb.
Yeah.
You know? But he's like, so you all think that maybe Ken Pantera is going to win? Well, I know that's what you think, and I know that's what Harley Race thinks, and I don't give a fuck what you think. This is my belt, and I'm the one, I'm the only one who's going to get in the ring with fucking Harley Race and fuck up his day. And then he storms away with the belt, and I'm like, now, in all those territories that you mentioned, he was a babyface in at least two of them, right?
Yep.
Because I don't know what it is. Maybe you can explain it, but in Texas, Bruiser Brody is a hero.
Yeah.
And everywhere else, he's a villain. And I could see why he'd be a hero. I mean, if I was in that crowd as a kid, I'd be like, that's the coolest motherfucker of all time.
Yeah, which is funny. He doesn't work in Houston like in the mid '80s during the Mid South because he's with Mid South. He's not with Mid South, but he became a heel in Southwest Championship Wrestling for like a 6-month run in '85, and he was like, I'm not talking about match quality, but for promo quality and being a villain, he was affiliated with Gary Hart. It's some. There's not a whole lot of footage out there, and they try to interview him.
Oh, must be great.
And they try to interview him, and he refuses to talk to the press. It's.
Oh, that sounds great.
He big shots him. Oh, it's awesome stuff.
That's getting big shotted by Bruce Brody. And just one other Bruce Brody thing is boots. And lots of people have done the Brody hairy boots. But here's the thing about Bruiser Brody's hairy boots. They're not just like big, bushy, hairy boots like Buzz Sawyer had. They look like he killed an animal.
Oh, yeah.
And skinned its pelt and by himself and sewed it onto his wrestling boots.
Yeah, you're totally Grizzly Adams, right?
Yeah, it's like roadkill on his goddamn boots. But he killed something and put it on his boots. He didn't go to the boot guy and go, like, well, I'd like, give me a furry pair. I'm going to make my, how much? Shit, I can do that myself with a knife and a glue, and a glue gun.
This is a pelt, yeah, you betcha.
You're going to get some pelts. Because, I mean, he does look like a French trapper. You know, picture him in a canoe.
Oh, man. Well, that's NWA On Demand this week in wrestling. Great stuff. We're going to have some more exciting stuff next week. Johnny, you have anything you got to plug? Anything you want to mention?
No, not really. But next week we're getting a match between Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Ivan the Terrible. And do you know anything about Ivan the Terrible?
I've been trying to do research. I can't find jack of him. There's one thing. I find an obituary that says he died in 1989, but... But this one made it sound like he was 60 something years old or 70. I can't imagine this guy was 60 when he was wrestling, because that was in 82. I can't find. I think this is supposed to be Mike Shaw from Canada, but I have not been able to find a whole hell of a lot of information on him.
Okay, that jumped out at me as a name. I'm like, I have never heard that name.
Never have I. And there was one from, like, that's the thing, that all the Ivan the Terribles I'm coming up with is this guy who started wrestling, it was born in, like, 1920. So I just can't imagine that's the same guy.
Mm. Okay, and awesome.
And hey, I did something I thought was pretty cool. I was on Clotheslines and Headlines on their last show. On the last segment, I interviewed Brad Stutz from CWF Atlantic. Stutzy. Yeah, really fun interview, talking about the history of the promotion, Battlecade, and how it's getting a lot of online press right now, and getting behind it and stuff. So
that's awesome, dude. That's awesome, because you know what? I was interviewing Stutzy on podcasts before it was cool.
There you go.
Yeah, a few years ago when they first started the pay-per-view experiment, and they were really promoting their first show. I put it out there. I'm like, hey, man, come on, What a Maneuver. You know, the 12 people who listen to us, maybe they'll buy one. And that first pay-per-view, I remember, I enjoyed more than any wrestling show that I'd seen that year. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
But so it's really, he's a great guy, and I'm really happy to hear that it's getting a lot of buzz.
Yeah, I'll tell you, my Observer Award, he won my Best Announcer. He's an incredible announcer. He's also the booker behind it. And
And he was also a character.
Yeah, he's not a character anymore. Yeah, but yeah, the promotion is doing fantastic.
Oh, that's so good to hear.
Yeah, so everyone check that interview out and follow me at Titans O Wrestling. See you later.
He came from Texas seeking fortune and fame. Rose pretty quickly to the top of the game. Defender of the downtrodden, king of the hill. Tag team champion with Al Madrill. Before a black and white TV in the middle of the night. I'm lying on the floor, I'm bathed in blue light. The telecast's in Spanish, I can understand some. And I need justice in my life. Here it comes, the Kai.